This is Here and Now. Tomorrow, President Trump leaves for a lengthy trip to Asia, where he will visit Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. It'll be a chance for Trump to reaffirm America's regional alliances and press China on trade issues. The visit also comes just after China's leader, Xi Jinping, announced that China was ready to take center stage in the world. Gideon Rockman, who is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, wrote a book earlier this year called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline. We spoke in April, and I asked him about that premise. Has it happened yet?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, obviously, people have been preoccupied by the rise of Asia on and off for many years. But I think you could look at the Obama years as a moment when quite important things happened. So that, for example, in 2014, the IMF came out with a ranking of the world's largest economies. And for the first time ever, they said that China, at least ranked by purchasing power, which is one way of doing it, is now the largest economy in the world. And in other ways, in the last 10 years, China's become the largest manufacturer in the world, the largest exporter in the world. And it's part of a broader phenomenon of growing Asian power. So in that ranking the IMF came up with, of the four top nations, three were in Asia. China, the US was second, and then there was Japan and India. And so the economic center of gravity of the world, I think, has now pretty clearly moved towards the Asia Pacific.
Does it matter, though, that the US is still the biggest military power?
Oh, sure, it does. Absolutely. And I think it sets up a tension because the US is still clearly the biggest military power, and it's also the biggest political power. It's the only superpower in the world. That's been that case ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the question really that the book wrestles with in different ways is, how is this mismatch between the shift of economic power towards Asia, how is that going to play out against the background of a world in which, in political and military terms, the US is still number one? How is the adjustment political power going to play out?
Well, you point out in this book that China is constantly just pushing boundaries to see how far it can go. And I wonder, how does China react when countries push back? Do they back off or do they stand firm?
It depends which country, to be honest. I think increasingly the Chinese have been learning that they can push around almost anybody except the United States. But that doesn't mean that they are prepared to defer to America. It just means that they will be a bit more subtle in the way that they use their power, so that they've advanced through sort of little steps in the South China Sea, building up their territorial claims. They certainly don't accept America's naval operations there, but they've tried to avoid direct confrontation. Whereas with other countries, smaller countries, it's much more evident that China now is really willing to throw its weight around.
Let's talk about numbers, because you cite an estimate that by 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will live in Asia, whereas the U.S. will be 5% of the world's population, the EU 7%. How important are the sheer numbers of population? Can you be the superpower in the world for a long time if you have such a smaller population than another country?
Well, I think that the weight of population does matter now much more than it did in the past. Because in the old days, the wealth gap between the advanced Western nations, and particularly the US, but also the Western Europeans and Asia, was so huge that it didn't really matter that, you know, there were hundreds of millions of Chinese, now 1.4 billion, 1.3 billion Indians, because they were very poor. So the Chinese economy, the Indian economy, was still smaller. That economic gap has narrowed. So the average Chinese is now about probably only about 25% as rich as the average American. But when you have that population, cumulatively, the economy is larger or as large, depends on the unit of measurement you want to use. And the same goes for India, which was a very poor country. There's still many people living in absolute poverty in India. But because they've been on the move economically, growing at 8, 9, 10% a year, they are now a big economy. But in response to your question about, well, can America continue to be the superpower? Yes, for a while, because it has other assets. It has allies, for example. There is such a thing as the Western Alliance. There is no Eastern Alliance. Asia's very, very divided. And that's really the key to American power in Asia, is that a lot of the Asian countries don't necessarily side with China. In fact, they're very scared of China, and they want the U.S. to stay a presence in the region. And Trump, for example, has been very wary of allies, regards them as exploiting America's security guarantees, regards countries like Japan and South Korea as almost as bad on trade as the Chinese. So there is that. And then I think the other thing is that there's a big question about American will. Would America really fight over rocks in the South China Sea? Would it really fight to protect outlying bits of territory of Japan? And as long as the Chinese can plant doubts about that, and some of Trump's rhetoric reinforces those doubts, then there's always a question mark to America's allies in the region. You know, is America really going to be there if the push comes to shove? There was quite a good line a Singaporean said to me, is that he said, yeah, of course we want America to stay, but we know that China will still be our neighbor in 1,000 years' time. But we don't know if America will still be a big Pacific power in 100 years' time.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Gideon Rockman, who is chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. His new book is Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, from Obama to Trump and Beyond. And Gideon Rockman, we have to talk about India, because India is the second most populous country after China. But China, as you point out in this book, is clearly very worried about India. They have created basically a ring of port cities from China all the way down to Africa to make sure that they've got the routes that they need to get the resources that they need, getting around India. And then this is something I didn't realize, that the Chinese are helping out Pakistan as much as possible in order to give India some trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what the Indians think. And I think they're increasingly worried by it, because you said that the Chinese are worried by the Indians, and they are a bit. But I think the Indians are even more worried about the Chinese, because they're that much further behind. And the Indians feel that the Chinese are trying to contain them partly by supporting their old adversary, Pakistan. It's pretty certain that the Pakistani nuclear program got some aid from China. And actually, China has a certain vulnerability, because a lot of its oil comes from the Middle East. It has to come a long way around. Chinese have basically sponsored the building of a very large port in Pakistan, which gives them a much shorter route to get the oil. So there's big infrastructure routes being built right across Pakistan to China. And then there's the other question, whether, as you remarked, China's also building up other alliances. It's got very close to Sri Lanka, which is the island nation at the bottom of India. It's built ports there. It's built ports in Burma. So if you kind of took a geostrategic look at the map, you would think, if you were Indian, there's almost what they call a string of pearls being built around us that they might one day tighten around our neck.
Well, it reminds you, even in the 21st century, that shipping is still really important to power.
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, it feels very 19th century, doesn't it, that people should still be worrying about sea routes and so on. But it does matter, because oil, to be blunt, I mean, America's slightly alleviated its problem because of the shale gas thing. So America's less dependent on Saudi oil than it used to be. China, however, is very dependent on oil from both Saudi Arabia and Iran. And one of the paradoxes of world affairs now is that the Straits of Hormuz, through which all this oil passes, are kept open by the U.S. Navy. And both sides think that's a bit peculiar. The Americans are thinking, why are we basically providing China security for it? And the answer to that, of course, is I spoke to Americans about this, and they thought, well, we have thought maybe we could pull out, but then how would we feel if actually the Chinese Navy was patrolling the Persian Gulf? And I think the Chinese, on the one hand, think it's great that they don't have to have this commitment in the Gulf, which comes with all sorts of complications to it. On the other hand, it makes them feel a bit vulnerable, because they think, well, actually, the American Navy is all along the route that our oil comes through. It's in the Gulf where the oil starts coming through, but then it's also by the Malacca Straits where it has to continue, which is this very narrow strait of water, the busiest waterways in the world, between Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And again, the U.S. Navy is based in Singapore, or rather operates out of Singapore. So the Chinese have what they call a Malacca Strait dilemma. They think, look, if there was ever a conflict, we could be in real trouble there.
So what would your one piece of advice to the Trump administration be to try to stop the Easternization of the world?
I would say you can't stop it. You're not going to be able to go back to the era in which America dominated both the global economy and dominated the global political scene. But that needn't be a disaster if you can, through a kind of judicious mix of policies, accept the inevitability of the rise of China, but then try to manage it so that you set some rules, both for the global economy, and you keep your alliances firm in Asia, but not so firm that you actually slide into a confrontation with China. Now, that's not an easy balance to strike,
right,
but it is the one that I think successive administrations in different ways have ended up with. It's sort of what the Bush administration was doing. It's what the Obama administration was doing. And I think any administration, even one whose rhetoric is quite as radical as that of Donald Trump's, when they look at the set of choices facing America, will probably end up, if they're sensible, with something similar, which tries to emphasize cooperation where you can, but set some guidelines and some lines for China on the use of force and on how it treats its neighbors. It's a fine balance to strike, but I don't think it's impossible.
That's Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times. His book is called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline. We spoke with him in April. President Trump takes his first trip as president to Asia tomorrow, and we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.